Welcome, everybody. It's the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am your host, Maggie Dawn. With me this afternoon is Anya Esther in the production booth. Welcome, everybody. 844-967-2789. Yesterday, I did a deep dive on the history of the Supreme Court's powers and the evolution of its shadow docket, which was a term coined by University of Chicago law professor in 2015. The professor's name is Will Bode. He's actually a conservative. He didn't mean it pejoratively, but it certainly has come to take on that meaning. And I brought us up to the point in the 80s when the Supreme Court, without a change in law, without telling anybody, fundamentally started to change its practice about how it hears emergency petitions. We're going to get to that in just a second, but I have to just, the article that dropped about the settlement reached in the fake electors case. Good on you, Wisconsin Law Forward. But boy, is this some buck passing of like the highest order. They are not paying any money, despite the fact that it cost Milwaukee County and Dane County an incredible amount of money to defend these spurious lawsuits, none of which won. And they agreed to never serve as electors in the future or to participate in the transmission of such documents again. How about this? How about you can't, you're going to like forfeit your license to practice law for a couple of these folks, at least for a period of time? You agree to not run for public office? And maybe like you will have to pay a whole lot of money if you engage in bald-faced lies about elections that undermine Wisconsinites' faith in them in the future. It's so hard for me to swallow it. Here's the statement. The elector defendants took the foregoing action because they were told that it was necessary. Told by whom? Well, the Trump campaign and the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Because they were told that it was necessary to preserve their electoral votes in the event a court challenge may later change the outcome of an election. They signed these fake elector things the day after the state Supreme Court rejected the legal challenge. Yes, there were a couple of federal cases moving, but they weren't going anywhere fast, and they did not amount to enough challenges to change the results. And by the way, those challenges were only in Milwaukee and Dane counties. No, there wasn't a court challenge that was going to change the outcome. To preserve their electoral votes, they're not their electoral votes, they're ours, aren't they? It's sort of like faux contrition. I'm sorry you feel that way because I'm such a jerk all the time is not a legit apology. Neither is this. Okay. But I promised us all some deep dive on the Supreme Court, so I'll just gently pivot back to that. That was gobsmacking to me. And you're gonna want to keep it locked all hour today because, boy, do we have an exclusive. Back on November 6th, I had Journal Sentinel reporter John Dietrich join us talking about the investigative reporting that John has done, a series of articles in partnership with the O'Brien Fellowship at Marquette University's School of Journalism about gun ownership in the state of Wisconsin, suicide rates. Quite an incredible bit of reporting. Been working on this for over a year. Well, they just dropped the next article this morning that has been in the series of articles and reporting that Mr. Dietrich and the Journal Sentinel has done. So I'm really happy I was able to get John to come and join us here this afternoon. So he's going to be with us at the bottom of the hour, followed there then by the Executive Director of Legal Aid, the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. You're not going to want to miss any of that, but let's get to the juicy business. When we last left our heroes, we were looking at the Supreme Court in the 80s. And what sort of started to change the way that the Supreme Court hears emergency appeals. And remember, there's two kinds of ways that the court hears or makes decisions that aren't in full, right? The things that we think about, like the abortion decision was like this 80-page thing, and it gets lots of press. And that's what most of us think of and talk about. That was the Roe v. Wade decision. That's the merits docket. But that's actually a small slice of what the court does. The vast majority of its work is in deciding which cases to hear. That's called the certiorari process. And then there are these requests for emergency action. And these requests for emergency action ask the court basically to prevent something from happening or allow something to happen. And there's supposed to be an emergency, like, you know, somebody's going to be executed. That's an emergency. And so we're not talking about the cert process, which is the vast majority of, it's huge bundles of what the court does, because they don't hear much of what they're requested to hear. In fact, I think one of the last statistics I heard, it's something like somewhere less than like 3% of cases that parties request the Supreme Court to hear, does the Supreme Court actually agree to hear? So when we last left this discussion, I had queued up that the courts had made the federal death penalty a non-starter. They had put a moratorium in place in 1972. In 1976, they said, "Eck, we're wrong. Let's start killing people again." And so there was a whole bunch of people that were basically in line to be killed by the federal government. And so a whole bunch of executions get scheduled. So you see this massive uptick. The executions are getting scheduled. So you see this big, huge uptick in these emergency requests for the Supreme Court to say, hold on, don't kill this person. There are some constitutional questions. Here's the statistic. In the 60s, the Supreme Court would receive 3 to 4 emergency death penalty requests per year. By 1983, they were receiving over 80. So like huge, huge change. And in 1988, the court stopped doing what it had done for decades. So before 1988, when the emergency death penalty request would come in, the United States was divided into 9 districts, and a single Supreme Court justice would decide that emergency, that request to stop the execution or to permit the execution to occur. They didn't speak on behalf of the court. There were often sort of abbreviated arguments in chambers, and a single judge would oftentimes write a short little decision addressing the emergency state. There was some deliberation, there was some argumentation, there were some written decisions, and you know who made the decision. It was the one justice. Well, in 1988, they got rid of it. They said, nope, the full court is going to hear all emergency applications. They did this on their own. They didn't tell a single person. It just changed one day. The interesting thing was, not only did it go from one justice to all 9 of them, those decisions on emergency applications that just one day in 1988 started to be handled differently, no decision, no argument, no briefing, all 9 of them vote, but no one knows who voted which way. So there's no attribution of who decided which way on these various emergency requests. Okay, way different than the way that they did it for decades and decades and decades before. And what you see in the 80s then, because there was this backlog effectively of executions waiting to happen, what you see in the 80s is a spate of 5-4 decisions on emergency death penalty applications to the court. So there is not unanimity about how they should handle these things. And what's really pernicious here is that there were many, many instances where they're not denying a stay of the execution, okay? So this, a stay of the execution would be the lower courts have ruled that the execution can't proceed, no constitutional infirmities, and the person facing execution still goes to the court, the Supreme Court, and says, we think you will find constitutional problems. Please stop my execution from happening. arguably, when the court turns those down, that's slightly less problematic because the lower courts didn't find any basis on full arguments and briefing to hold or stop the execution. But what ends up happening is that there are far, far more cases in the 80s where it's not the person that's going to be killed that is asking the court to change what's happening. It's the state that is seeking to execute the person. So this is really important. In those cases, what's happening is that lower courts found that there were constitutional problems and said this person shouldn't be executed. And the state disagrees and it's appealing to the Supreme Court. But before there's any arguments before the Supreme Court, the state asks for the court to step in on an emergency basis, not to stop an execution, but to allow the state to kill the person. And the most pernicious thing here is that those emergency applications, you have to effectively, there has to be some finding by the court, even though they don't explain it, that the state is somehow harmed if they don't get this emergency relief. Explain to me, how is the state harmed by not being able to kill someone when lower courts with full argument have found that there are constitutional problems? One would think that the most drastic measure any government can take, which is killing one of its citizens, should only be undertaken in the most extraordinary circumstances, and certainly not when other judges have found that there are problems. But we see many, 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 it ends up being tens of tens of tens each year of the Supreme Court on emergency basis unstaying executions. And no one is paying any attention. Because unless you are the victim, the victim's family, the state itself, the person who's going to get executed, or the person who's going to be executed, their family, it doesn't affect you. So know, as this begins to explode in Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you want to join our discussion about the Supreme Court shadow docket or about the great research and reporting Mr. Dietrich has done for the Journal Sentinel, you can always give us a call, 844-967-2789. That number takes text messages, too. Very handy. I will get to you. So before we heard some important messages, I had explained how all of a sudden in the 80s, the Supreme Court changes how it handles emergency death penalty requests. And now, without knowing which justices voted which way on a bunch of split decisions, they basically are saying, oh, yes, state, go ahead and execute these people without any briefing, without any argument, and without them having to explain themselves in situations where lower courts found constitutional infirmities. That's scary. By the way, still going on. And nobody was paying attention because, again, the stakes for those involved in those executions, very, very high, literally life and death. But beyond that small circle of people, those things happen without much notice. And even within the death penalty space, what happens in John Smith's emergency request from Missouri often doesn't have anything to do with Mr. Doe's request coming out of Florida. So even within the death penalty space, the cases didn't have much to say to one another. But all of a sudden, this manner of handling emergency appeals, emergency requests. So we have this change in 1988, and then it changes again. There's no change in the law. There's no announcement. The Supreme Court doesn't say, hey, in the interest of transparency and accountability, dear American public, we are the highest court in the land. Now hear this. We're going to do something differently again. In the 2010s, all of a sudden, they started to receive and use this same black box approach to emergency requests outside of the death penalty space, in the regulatory space. And the vast amount of what gets brought before the Supreme Court are criminal cases and regulatory cases. Does this federal agency have the power to make this rule or enforce this regulation and law in this way? And all of a sudden, the Supreme Court one day just drops an unauthored, unattributed, unexplained order granting an emergency stay on then-President Obama's climate agenda. It was the requirement that every state reduce its carbon emissions by 2030. And the vote on that one happened in the middle of the night. They didn't write an opinion. They hadn't heard an argument. A brief had not been filed in the Supreme Court. No arguments, no attribution. 5-4. It happened in February of 2016. In June of 2017, the court unstayed Trump's travel ban 2.0. They allowed the Muslim ban to go into effect. You may remember this. It was like all of a sudden you woke up in the morning and like a whole bunch of people from a whole bunch of countries couldn't come into the United States. You're like, wait a minute, did I miss a case here somewhere? Wait, that the Supreme Court did that? I didn't hear that. There weren't even arguments before the Supreme. You were right. They just did it in the middle of the night. Black box shadow docket. This is the last shift. So now these new procedures that had only been used in death penalty cases are used in case after case after case that have statewide and national consequences, that change rights and privileges overnight, that change federal policies overnight. COVID policies, voting rules, Biden's OSHA rules, immigration things, our healthcare rights. President Biden's loan forgiveness plan. That was not a fully briefed case. It was the black boxed shadow docket. There's nowhere else in our system of government where rights can be so fundamentally impacted without any accountability or explanation. It simply doesn't exist anywhere else. Whatever you think about the regulations that the EPA or the FDA or the FCC may come about, there's a note and comment period. There's a legal process that is transparent. There are FOIA laws, Freedom of Information Act requests. There is accountability and transparency, except here for the highest court in the land. The most notable example of this just happened in April of this year. On Good Friday, a known anti-abortion, anti-choice judge, part of the Christian nationalist movement in Amarillo, Texas, mifepristone not available for women to use anymore. A 20-year FDA approval was wiped off the map by the Fifth Circuit judge. It then went to the Supreme Court. You remember this? Everybody freaked out. No mifepristone. What's going on? And within a matter of weeks, the Supreme Court lifted the stay in the middle of the night that that judge had put in place and restored access to mifepristone. You may agree or disagree with that decision, but that ain't supposed to be the way things work. Unauthored opinion, no accountability, no rationale given. And there are more and more of these cases every year where emergency requests are being used to fundamentally shape our rights and liberties and the way that we live our lives every day. Here's the statistic. The number of total requests for emergency intervention by the Supreme Court under both the Bush and Obama administrations, that is 16 years, folks. The total number of those, 8. The total number of requests during the Trump administration, 4 years, a quarter of the time, 41. I'm going to say these numbers again. 16 years over two different presidential double terms, one Republican, one Democrat, 8 emergency requests to the Supreme Court during the 4 years of President Trump's administration, 41. And it is being used, and it was extraordinarily leveraged during the Trump administration, and the statistics bear this out, to effectively put policies into effect before they had full legal review. And when you're talking about banning countries and people from coming in because they have a different religious belief, which seems to be something in our founding that had to do with religious freedoms, I don't know. When the issues strike at the very foundational principles of our democracy, of our republic, one would think perhaps not through emergency interim decision-making by the Supreme Court dropped in the middle of the night with no authorship attribution, no explanation, no briefing, no written arguments, no accountability whatsoever. My point, folks, is this ain't the way it is supposed to work. And I'm not quite done yet. We're going to have reporter Mr. Dietrich hang on for a second, because if you're sitting there thinking, well, I like the way the Supreme Court is deciding these things, the inconsistency, my friends. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. We're going to be joined in a moment by investigative reporter John Dietrich of the Journal Sentinel, who's done some incredible work on how the culture of guns in Wisconsin has been changing. Just had an article drop this morning in the Journal Sentinel. We're going to bring John in a moment. But I got to finish our saga of the Supreme Court shadow docket. It has now morphed into something that has never, ever been seen in the history of our country or the history of the Supreme Court. They are issuing decisions on request for emergency intervention without any explanation. And these emergency interventions are impacting our rights. And in many cases, taking away long existing rights. And in fact, that happened in 2021, ahead of the Dobbs ruling. On September 6th, 2021, women in the state of Texas woke up and they no longer had a right to seek the health care of their choosing. And that happened because the Texas 6-week abortion ban that had been stayed pending appeals of its constitutionality was magically unstayed by the Supreme Court without a word of explanation overnight. It shouldn't be that way, whatever you may think of abortion. And if you are sitting there saying, well, I like the outcomes of their cases, this is just fine with me, because clearly they're whatever their emergency decisions are, they're getting things right, and so it's okay. Well, that's actually a premise that you can test by looking at the court decisions, because what comes after these emergency rulings, which I don't even want to call rulings, they're just arbitrary, unsigned orders by the court, is that the case on its full merits eventually is heard by the court. So you can actually go and look, hey, whatever they did in their emergency order, whether to let a law or regulation go into effect or not execute or whatever, does that match up with their eventual ruling on the full merits of the case? And guess what, folks? It is scary stuff here. Extremely, extremely inconsistent. I'm going to look at just one area, the immigration cases. Under the Trump administration, his immigration policies were overwhelmingly allowed to go into effect even when lower courts had found them constitutionally problematic. An unsigned, unauthored, explanation-free, late-night emergency decisions by the Supreme Court. And to date, a far larger proportion of President Biden's immigration policies have been prevented from taking effect by this same Supreme Court. Again, you may be saying, well, that's because President Trump's policies were better. Nope. The cases that have come to their full merits before the Supreme Court, this court has found that far more of Donald Trump's policies are unconstitutional than President Biden's. In other words, there's no consistency. They're getting it wrong in their emergency rulings. You cannot explain their emergency rulings. When you take them one at a time, you can fashion up a reasonable justification. But when you look at them together, there is no through line of articulable principle or explanation that would explain all of these on a consistent basis. So what is terrifying here and should be terrifying to all of us is that you have an unaccountable branch of government who is making decisions that strike at the heart of our democracy, our founding principles, changing people's rights overnight without any accountability, without explaining their rationales, and they're doing so inconsistently. And what it leads you to is this conclusion that it is not objective legal principles or informed and deliberative process that is leading to these outcomes from the black box shadow docket, but that it is rather the expression of political preferences. And so to anyone who's listening, who's conservative and says, I hate activist judges and this is bad and judges shouldn't be politicians, then so too here, my friends. The Supreme Court is out of control. And they've been allowed to get that way because Congress has become so dysfunctional. Which ties back to where we started today. And that is that gerrymandering and lying about elections and all of this nonsense fosters congressional dysfunction because there are some clear ways to rein the Supreme Court in. Congress could legislate what the Supreme Court can make an emergency intervention regarding. They could say you could only do it about these kinds of cases. They could restrict or say you can only take emergency action if it leads to this kind of outcome. In other words, not allowing the state to execute someone more quickly or not depriving rights that have been longstanding. So this is all subject to congressional regulation. And by the way, I haven't even talked about Supreme Court ethics. So what you have is an out of control branch of government with zero accountability who won't even show up in a congressional hearing to answer to some serious ethical improprieties who are making judgments based on political preferences and not legal principles and constitutional arguments. We can do better. I'm sure we will revisit this because the Supreme Court's going to give us more gifts of these completely unaccountable late night, midnight, 2 a.m. drops of decisions that deprive people of their rights. And eventually they'll come for your rights too. But now we're going to move on to the great reporting in the Journal Sentinel by my friend John Dietrich, who joined us last on the Maggie Dawn Show on November 6th. If you want to hear that episode, go ahead and check it out on the website. It's there. This is the fifth article, is that correct, John, in your series of reporting?
Yeah, I mean, as you add them up, it's actually all in terms of separate pieces, there are now 14 different pieces out there dropped in sort of three chunks. But and we tried to write in ways that would be not, you know, more like not overwhelming one big piece, but kind of let people's stories sort of breathe a little bit on their own.
Well, this one was certainly compelling. The headline, folks, is poll of Wisconsin gun owners show more getting guns for self-defense, and 3 in 5 of Wisconsin gun owners keep them locked up, which is certainly good news. Tell us a little bit about the poll that was put out and some of these headline results that you all found, John.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks again for having me on, Maggie. So this is part of the O'Brien Fellowship for Public Service Journalism at Marquette. I did this over the past year or so, still worked at Journal Sentinel during that time. And one of the things we can do during that time is sort of work with different resources at the university. I worked together with Charles Franklin, who's a well-known pollster in the state, and he formulated some questions for his polls that were last year leading up to the Supreme Court. There are some different gun questions in there. And from that discussion, we decided to formulate a poll that would be directed toward gun owners only. A lot of times Charles's polls will have gun questions in there, but this is just for gun owners. And so we had a poll that was an online poll that would ask several questions. And if one of the questions that's like an item that you would have in your house, and if somebody said that item is a gun, then you would drop into the poll. So all we got were gun owners, 354 gun owners, run by Dynana LLC, which is an online survey company. And so in any case, what this survey did was try to ask, we ended up with 31 questions, which is kind of on the heavy side, but we wanted to ask questions that would present maybe in a different way. I've heard from gun owners in my previous reporting about how they felt like poll questions might be written in such a way that there was bias, or sometimes even treating people like specimens, sort of oddities, you know, that sort of thing, sort of language that didn't speak to them. And so we formulated the language working with Charles and gun owners. And we tried to go after some particular areas. Maybe questions are not typically answered, but we ask things like, how many guns do you have? What kind of guns do you have? How do you keep them in your home? Have you purchased since the pandemic? Do you have a CCW? How often do you go to the range? Training and that sort of thing. And we also touched on the issue of suicide, which again was a big part of my previous part of this package, was talking about the propensity of firearms and suicide in Wisconsin.
It's really interesting when you layer your reporting together and you view it as part of a whole, looking at the fact that we're seeing an enormous explosion in firearm suicides. And then this particular drill down poll talking to only gun owners, which shows that the majority of gun owners, according to this poll, are locking their guns up. It's what's so pernicious about the suicide problem, right? Is like, if you're committed to killing yourself, you'll go get your gun out of the locked box. Here are a couple of statistics, and I was just wondering if you wanted to tell me some of your observations here that really stuck out. Women are more likely to lock up their guns than men. Very fascinating. There was it looked to me like there was an extrapolatable point that there clearly has been an increase in first-time gun buyers following the pandemic, right? People concerned for their personal safety. Tell me about what you're finding going on there.
Yeah, so if you look at like the overall reason that people own firearms in Wisconsin, hunting is number one, and Charles's polls have shown that, and that number could be as high as 80% in the recent past. It now sits around 70 or a little bit less. But what's interesting is the more recent purchasing, vis-a-vis since March of 2020. The number one reason that those who bought since the pandemic told us was that self-protection is just out ahead quite a bit from hunting, from sport shooting, and other like collecting. So so self-protection is a big one. We also see the number of women and younger and Black and Brown and LGBTQ. All those categories are going up. Okay. One of the things to be careful, though, in this, and I just want to qualify this, that our number is 354. It's a big number by some regards, but we're also talking about a population. in Wisconsin, there's about 2.4 million homes. About half of those have a firearm in them. So, and then there's more owners than homes. And so we're talking about, you know, well over a million people. So we don't want to speak for this, and we have to be really careful when the numbers get small.
Yep.
So that's one thing that we have to think about. But to your point,
for data nerds, if I can, John, for data nerds, it's not a statistically significant. We can't look at the stats and go, yep, that's extrapolatable to the whole. Yep. These are not rough representative. Indicators. Yep. That's just a little bit over a minute left. And I would be happy to have you back on in the new year, John. I think folks talking about guns and gun safety and gun ownership may be a little heavy as we're moving into the holiday season. But what are some of the important or surprising takeaways that you want to leave with people? And everybody, go to JS Online and check out John Dietrich's reporting.
Well, thank you. I think some things to note in here is just, again, when you think about the largest category of people with storage of guns is that they are locked up. Okay, so the smallest category was unlocked and loaded. So that's one thing to kind of keep in mind. We did some profiles here. The demographic and the look of gun owners is changing. And I think there's also a real commitment towards safety among gun owners that I've talked to. And that's a big one. And I'm going to be following up on that. This isn't the end of our project. So there's more coming.
Well, congratulations to you, John, on just an incredible body of work here. I look forward to talking to you more. I appreciate your time this afternoon. For those of you who may be in Milwaukee County, we do have harm reduction vending machines that are now out there. You can get gun locks for free. They're in a lot of county facilities, so go check that out before you hit the holidays, folks. Thanks again, John. Happy travels. I know you're getting on a plane soon, and happy holidays to you and yours. Keep it locked, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. We'll take a couple callers when we get back. Everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We may get Colleen Foley on here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society. There's a tow going on outside the studio, and parking is a disaster. But thank goodness we've got some of our loyal listeners and callers, as well as Diane Anderson, candidate for the 1st Congressional District. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. Diane, what would you like to say this afternoon?
Hi, Maggie. Always impressed with what you have to bring to the show each evening. I just wanted to say that this whole issue of emergency Supreme Court cases and the congressional input not being there, well, one thing that I will vow is that if I get elected to Congress, I will be there to listen and look at the cases that are being brought out there. And I really think that if more healthcare professionals with advanced degrees were elected to Congress, that they have the extra knowledge to be able to give the input to say whether or not these cases are emergency or not emergency.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Thanks so much for the call, Diane. There's far too many lawyers in Congress. It's like the dominant profession by like leaps and bounds, which I've always found problematic. Lawyers are generalists. That's just what we are. We don't bring typically particular subject matter expertise to bear. CJ, what you got?
Well, there's so much I'd like to discuss with you, Maggie.
Hey, pick one thing.
Illegal immigration, 12,000 record.
Okay, I don't want to argue about immigration. My point on the show yesterday and today was, we deserve transparency and accountability from our highest court in the land. What do you think? Should we be able to understand why the Supreme Court is deciding things the way that they are? Whatever we think about the immigration problem.
Well, that's the point. They pick and choose which laws are being enforced, and that's why the Biden administration.
But isn't that a problem, CJ? Like, don't you think that that's a problem, that the Supreme Court is picking and choosing and not explaining a thing and doing it in the middle of the night? And we don't know which justices voted this way, and they're inconsistent. It sounds like you agree with me.
Well,
like, that's a problem, right?
Law. The point is that the executive branch is not doing that. The this president,
not doing what?
The city of Stoughton moved in, Maggie, yesterday to our that's the one that were actually caught.
Okay, we've lost the thread. Mark from the SAC, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Maggie. And the Supreme Court should never rush their decision, especially on the death penalty. With the awesome power of the Supreme Court to do this kind of thing, the awesome power of the state to take somebody's life from them, that the Supreme Court should never rush into those decisions, and that it should never be done in the dark of night. It should also should be done in the bright daylight, because they can make these decisions. These judges should remember that I think it's either in ancient Babylon or ancient Persia, the corrupt judges, the death penalty for them was to be flayed alive and their skins used to cover the judicial bench. Now, I'm not suggesting we do that, but these judges need to recognize that these decisions, any of these decisions, because some of these decisions are life and death, regardless of the death penalty or not, that they should be done in the light of day, not the secrecy thing that I think that we established our Constitution to get away from that, because that's what we protested against. You know, merry old England, that judges were able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's thanks so much for the call, Mark. I appreciate you as ever and always. The interesting thing that Professor Vladek points out in his book is that when you look at Federalist 51, it says that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. And what he means there is that when the Supreme Court starts to overreach, starts to look like it's not accountable, starts to look like they don't really care if they've got a code of ethics or not, that it is Congress that needs to jealously guard its power and step in to curtail this unaccountable Supreme Court making willy-nilly inconsistent decisions in the dark of night. Thanks for the call, Mark. Really happy to be joined now by my good friend, Colleen Foley, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. Welcome back, Colleen. It's good to see you, friend.
Hey, Maggie, thanks for having me.
Of course. You might be breathing a little heavy. The parking out there is bananas. Welcome. I called out the Legal Aid Society on Giving Tuesday last week because you guys do such important work. If you folks have missed Colleen before on my show, tell everybody what it is that you all do.
Yeah, so the Legal Aid Society is a Milwaukee institution. We're 107 years old, and we provide free civil legal services to qualifying low-income Milwaukeeans, and that's on matters including housing security, health and wealth issues, for, you know, sharing information about estate planning and the intergenerational transfer of wealth in terms of home ownership. We also do consumer work, everything about garnishments and auto loans and all of those such things. And we are court-appointed guardian ad litem for children at risk.
So important. Don't we all wish we had the Legal Aid Society to call up? Because that's all stuff, Colleen, that we all deal with in our lifetimes in some way, shape, or form. If people want to donate time, donate money, get involved, or learn more about the Legal Aid Society, where do they go to get that information?
Folks should go to www.legalaidmke.com, or you can call us at 414-727-5300. But we've got a terrific website that we just revamped, and we welcome questions or comments and donations for sure, so we can continue to operate for another 107 years.
Amen to all that. That's 414-727-5300. You just Google Milwaukee Legal Aid Society. It'll get you right there. We've got just about a minute left. Colleen, you've spent your entire lifetime as a lawyer in service to the public. Why did you choose that?
That's a good question. I think for most of us, you know, giving back in whatever way you do in your life brings it meaning. And I'm from, you know, my grandparents were immigrants, and I just think that there's opportunity for all, and we all do better if we extend our reach to those in the community who need assistance. because it's good for the wealth and health of the entire community.
Yeah, this is not a zero-sum game, and Legal Aid Society certainly makes it better for all of us by helping some of us that are on the edge from time to time. Thank you, Colleen, for the work that you do and to the entire Legal Aid Society agency. Happy holidays to you, my friend. Happy holidays to John Dietrich. Thanks for listening to the Wednesday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. I'll be back tomorrow. If they can't raise my